Welcome to the debating chamber of the Cambridge Union Society. In over 200 years, the Cambridge Union has paid host to politicians, academics, sportsmen and entertainers. Today, it's host to the Eat Cambridge Food Debate. Under discussion is Cambridge food, art or science. And in the chair is Dr. Sue Bailey.
Let me introduce our panel, which are starting on my right-hand side. Is Dr. Vivaya Kalnikaita, and I hope I've said your name correctly.
Yes.
Good. And she is the founder of Dovetailed, which is an award-winning design studio and innovation lab based in Cambridge. And she leads a panel of very talented designers and scientists, and they're particularly involved in creating novel physical and digital experiences. But what makes her of interest to a foodie? Well, that is because she has produced and invented with her skilled team a 3D printing technique that prints with liquids. And they're currently looking at the application of this within the food industry. I remember trying this at a Food Matters Live conference, I think a couple of years ago, and being absolutely fascinated by it, thinking, ooh, now this looks really good. And she's also potentially thinking of doing some sort of crowdfunding investment to take our rather interesting little tabletop kit into production. So you too will be able to print your own 3D liquids. Then next, Tim Haywood. And probably needs no introduction to any Cambridge foodie. But what you may not know is he originally trained as a photographer and then worked in the advertising industry for 15 years, involved in marketing planning, is a digital guru, and has been a creative director for very many well-known advertising and PR agencies. Then, of course, he discovered his calling as a foodie and has been very much developing as an entrepreneur, a writer, and a restaurateur, and is a food critic and columnist for the Financial Times and The Guardian, presents on the Radio 4 food programme, and is a regular panellist on The Kitchen Cabinet. Has also won numerous Guild of Food Writers awards and magazine awards, and probably, however, is best known in Cambridge for reopening with his wife the very famous Cambridge bakery and restaurant Fitzbillies, only in summer 2011, so no more than 5 years ago, and just about to open Fitzbillies 2 on Bridge Street. Let me now introduce you to Alex Rushmer. And Alex Rushmer is an award-winning chef, food writer, and owner of the very critically acclaimed, in a very good way, the Cambridge restaurant The Hole in the Wall. And he graduated from this illustrious university in 2005 with a degree in social political sciences, because of course Cambridge doesn't do food science. And after a brief attempt to seek work in the halls of Westminster, realized his true calling lay in the kitchen. And in 2010 was a finalist on MasterChef and opened The Hole in the Wall 12 months later. And of course, The Hole in the Wall has gone from strength to strength. Let me now move on to Ben Aveling, who is very much, again, a name in the Cambridge area because they founded the Radmore Farm Shop on Chesterton Road. And he has developed all the artisan products that he sells, and because he is at the heart of actually producing and dealing with farming and is very much involved as a butcher, a chef, a baker, a food enthusiast, and also a Cambridge News columnist. And so he's particularly involved at the moment in developing his online store and very much involved in supporting the local business and really is involved in encouraging people in Cambridge to buy the best. Then, Joe Kennedy, who is from Black Bar Brewery, and as he calls himself, a brew monkey from Little Lair in near Harston. And in fact, in Harston, if you wish to go and go along to his brewery tap nights, you will find him lairing in there. So he also has a very, very distinguished background in the sense that he has a BSc in brewing and distilling from Heriot Watt University, I think one of the few universities that does have this very specialised brewing degree. And then he's worked in Harveston Brewery in Ulva, and then brewery at the Old Cannon Brew Pub in Suffolk, and then created almost from scratch his Black Bar Brewery in Harston in 2011. And they now have a whole range of seasonal and cask and bottled beers, plus a brewery shop. Not least, of course, is Dr. Marianne Ha, and she is from our local university, the Anglia Ruskin University, and is a registered public health nutritionist, member of the Institute of Food Science and Technology, and a director of East Anglia Food Link. And they're particularly involved in achieving sustainable and resilient food supplies within the east of Anglia. Sorry, east of England, not India.
Doing well.
Do excuse me, we've suddenly shifted continents here.
But that would be good too.
Yes, it would be rather fun, wouldn't it? Perhaps we will solve all the world's problems. Anyway, what she does do is also involved in writing for Public Health England. She's written a carbohydrates and health report and is aware of the fact that there are lots of questions in the whole area of nutrition, food, sustainability. So, a very, very interesting panel. And what we're going to do is ask some questions, particularly directing it at certain people on the panel. But then, as you've all got yourselves mic'd up, do feel very free to ask questions of your co-panelists. And obviously, if people within the audience wish to ask some questions, then feel free to do so as well. Let's start off by looking at the sort of more radical end of the science of food. And first of all, I'd like to be asking Alex and then Vivaya, and possibly Tim to interject, about what you think your take is on scientific approach of molecular gastronomy. Is it now really old hat? And are we much more interested in food foraging, flavour? Are we now locavores? So, what do you really think? Has it had its day, or can we be coming back to it?
I don't think it's ageing particularly well. I think molecular gastronomy is one of those things that's... It suffered immediately because the people who are most intimately associated with the movement quickly tried to remove themselves away from it. It was a label that was conveniently placed upon this notion that we should be taking a more scientific approach to cooking. I looked up a couple of dates on my way over here. Ferran Adrià El-Bulli won his third Michelin star in 1997, and Heston Blumenthal won his third Michelin star in 2004. And I think we've come a really, really long way since then. Ferran Adrià has closed El-Bulli since. He closed it 5 years ago, I think. And I think what's most indicative of the fact that we are moving away and that molecular gastronomy isn't spoken about in the same way that it used to be even 5 years ago is the scale and the speed of the reaction against it and how quickly people have been keen to take up the René Redzepi approach, which is the sort of the full-on new Nordic locavore nature of it. And the backlash against molecular gastronomy has been really quite swift and really quite fast. That's not to say that it's a movement that didn't have anything good going for it. I think as chefs, we all benefit from having an awareness of what is going on in the pot or the pan or the oven. It's just the fact that it's not spoken about in such revered terms and is in danger, actually, of becoming regarded as the sort of the nouvelle cuisine of the noughties.
I think molecular gastronomy is just another form of cooking. The association from how it was used is it was kind of very associated with very high-end restaurants and cuisine. What we've been looking at is to see if those techniques or some of the kind of inspiration from molecular gastronomy could be used together with more traditional cooking, so kind of accessorizing food rather than everything on the plate is derived from that particular cooking technique.
I think we do miss a point if we think that molecular gastronomy is just something to do with those people that made a living out of it and a huge amount of fame out of it. I mean, both Ferran and Heston there won't go anywhere near it. They won't admit to ever having called it molecular gastronomy or ever been involved in it in any way whatsoever. But the big thing you notice when you talk to chefs is the generational difference that they made. So when I trained years and years and years ago, everything was French. I don't speak French except in a kitchen when you swear at me in French. And you know, it is ridiculous how much that particular cuisine affected all of our training. And that was what most of us regard as classic food. There is a generation of chefs now, and I'm hiring these guys quite a lot. You will have had the same thing. You may even be of this generation in the sense that actually food is another form. You can apply science to food right the way across the board. Mm-hmm. Now, I spent years and years and years being told by different chefs the different ways you were supposed to set a quiche. You know, you whack it and it wobbles, or no, you use that oven over there and you use it for an hour and 15 minutes, not a moment longer. Or you realize that an egg congeals perfectly at 63.2 degrees or whatever it is, and you stick a probe thermometer in it. Now, that is the huge change that's occurred, because actually all of us, as part of the canon of the skills we have, are using science integrated. Those guys use those skills. They use quite a lot of stuff they were getting from the food industry. I don't know if you've ever sat in one of those places and had, yes, it's a matrix of cheese air in a corn foam. Actually, it's a cheesy Watsit. Precisely what it is, like a 4-inch wide cheesy Watsit. But those technologies were used and integrated. But what it's really done for me is blown the complete lid off a very, very old-fashioned, farty, stuck-in-the-mud way of approaching food. And I don't want to lose any of the individual traditions of the peasant foods that these things came from, but a lot of the high-end stuff was so stagnant. And it really shook that up. And it actually meant that a lot of people get into it that otherwise couldn't. Similar things have happened to brewing, I've noticed. Mm. You know, it's not just old geezers passing it on to each other and keeping it all a bit witchcraft. It's science now, as it should be.
The science, yeah, with you saying that they've brought the science probes, the measurements, everything else. That's how I was trained. Mm. You know, that's early 2000s. I was trained with this temperature in the mash tun, this temperature in the kettle, this temperature in the fermentation. But then also the fact that if you change any one of those, you change the beer. And that's the art and science argument in brewing that we're discussing today. To yeah. say, yes, you can do it the old-fashioned way and poke and look at it and kind of say, oh, yeah, it's 20 minutes past 10, we should have had a pint by now and the next mash will run off after that pint. Now it's all done on timings and temperatures, pHs, pressures. That's how we work it.
But I'm interested when people start using this term modernism as well. So when it stopped being called molecular cuisine, it started being called modernist cuisine. And every time in art or culture or philosophical history you hear the word modernist used, it's fascinating because what you're doing is you're positioning yourself automatically against everybody else that's gone before you. By being a modernist, you're calling everybody else an old pillock. And it's kind of interesting how we've gone through that and we're coming out the other side of it. I think what will happen next is most
I think it's... People are still using these techniques. It's just that they're not talking about them. You know, you go to Noma and he's got fermentation tanks set up and he's monitoring pH levels and temperatures all over the place. But he is focusing much more on the use of local and seasonal ingredients, the hyper-local and hyper-seasonal ingredients. And it's the speed at which these trends are changing that I find really interesting, actually. Yeah. And you know, I was sort of setting up my stall a little too far in one direction, I think, to sort of try and spur on a bit of discussion. But it's not, as I said, it's not so much that these techniques are old hat. The term molecular gastronomy is certainly old yes. hat. And people's perception of it really is. And you struggle to go to a high-end restaurant now and find a foam or a sphere or a gel in a prime location on a plate. But the other thing to bear in mind is that, you know, Ferran Adrià's cooking was rooted in some really, really classical Catalan yes. cuisine as well. He was all about the ingredients, and he still is, and he's still vehemently, he's adamant that he uses the best and the local produce he possibly can. It's just a case of focus. It's people's perception of where this focus lies that we're talking about more than the validity of the methods themselves, I think.
And I hope the backlash isn't too great, because actually there's some really good stuff in there. I mean, I was being shown some stuff recently that they're going to use for food in hospitals that involves sous-viding the food in such a way that it can be tracked 100% by a barcode on a card to the patient. And so all allergens are accounted for at an early stage. The temperature at which it's served is controlled completely, and the cooking appliance will actually register the fact that it has been eaten and send a signal to somebody to warn them if the food hasn't been eaten. Now, I can't say there's anything other than brilliant in that. You know, as long as somebody's putting some decent ingredients in the front end of that system, I'm really, really happy that proper people are getting decent food as a result, which they otherwise wouldn't, in a massively de-skilled far end of the industry at delivery point. So there's some good stuff there, if we don't throw it all out with the bathwater.
Right, let's move on to the next question then. Do consumers want a safe and cheap product, or are they really a bit more concerned about product authenticity? So do consumers really care about provenance and where their food and drink comes from? And do they want to hear a little bit more about the interesting backstory, the person who's brewed or created the food? Or are they just reliant on science and getting a pre-processed type of food stuff that's convenient, easy, and just going to arrive on the plate? So I'm going to ask Joe first about beer and the whole brewing area. Is it become an awful trend now? And what do we really think about how the beer is made before we actually drink it?
Has beer become trendy? If I borrow Ben's shirt and stand up, yes, I'd probably be about as trendy in brewing as I could be.
I wasn't going to say anything. It's okay.
Beer has become very trendy over the last few years, but at the same time, gin has become very trendy. Trends come in and out of fashion, things move around, but beer has been around so long that you can give it a new name, as the panel has been discussing on molecular gastronomy. Sorry, that was completely new when I read it. I was like... Is it fashionable? Yes. Is it important that we know where our food is coming from? I think highly, but I'm sitting on the panel with people who are going to agree with me. I think we're sitting in a room full of foodies who are going to agree with me. But I was in a lecture in San Francisco a few years ago, a lovely lecture by one of my favourite brewers, Professor Charlie Banforth of USC Davis. And he said he put three beers together. One that was brewed how I brew, whole ingredients, run in a simple brewery. One that was produced by his employer, we won't mention them, be fair. And one that had never been near a hop or a bit of malt or anything. And he put them in front of his students and said, drink. They didn't care which one they drank until you told them the story afterwards. Then suddenly they didn't want the chemical lab-made one. They were okay with the middle one, but they're quite a large brewery and it's at a nice price. But they were all interested in spending that little bit more money on going for the artisan produced. I'm glad that when people come and see my brewery and meet me and talk with me, they understand that actually everything I put into my beers is a whole ingredient you can recognise. Yeah? If I've got oranges in it, it's got an orange in it. Yeah? If I put bay and rosemary in it, it is bay and rosemary herbs I've taken out of my mate's gardens, a tree I've lopped down or whatever. Yeah? That gets them interesting, realising that their food doesn't have to come in a plastic container in the back of a supermarket. Yeah? I went looking for a goat recently for a curry, and I saw a local butcher. And surprise, surprise, the local butcher said, yes, we can get goat for you. Really useful, it's Ben as well. But
you just reminded me, I've got another phone call.
Yeah, thanks. Got the curry ingredients.
Yes, yeah, really excellent.
I think with all food, where we've had the horse meat scandal, where we've had cheap food, and we're realising that the old, personification of Ben again, farmers, vegmongers, butchers, bakers are all around, and the flavour difference is huge, and the quality of the meat is better, your bacon doesn't shrink. Do people still want cheap food? Yes, but probably because we haven't got to them yet.
I would add to that, that while people are very interested in where their food comes from, not everybody can afford to actually get local artisan produced food. If people could afford it, I think there would be a lot more.
I think you've hit the nail on the head.
But it's not, if people could afford it, it's that they're not getting enough income, I think. You need the money, I mean the farmers, artisans need the money to be able to produce, and it is the cost, it is in fact it's a bit low if anything, but it's that people are not actually paid enough to be able to afford what they would like.
And also, I mean, it also goes beyond that in a quite an evil way. I I worked on the horse meat business at the BBC. They called in every available journalist who knew anything about food because it was such an incredible amount of stuff to be dealt with. And we were watching the stuff coming in live, and there were a couple of interns there who were working with us. And somebody wanted to run a story that said how great it would be for artisan butchers. You know, this is going to be tremendous because, of course, nobody's going to go to a supermarket or buy their meat from the supermarkets anymore. And one of the interns just disappeared for a couple of hours and came back with some terrifying figures about how long the country would last if we only had the artisan butchers. Yeah. Because the supply chain, we have a problem in this country, I guess, because we've had rationing and governmental control of food here longer than they did in communist Russia. Mm. You know, we had rationing in World War I. Yep. We had a depression in between the two when we still had basically state-run food production in a lot of different ways. We're going to rationing in World War II. Rationing ends in the mid-50s. Around that time, everybody's believing the idea of market forces and the power of the supermarkets. And the supermarkets are great. Supermarkets did great things, but they did great things to a country that had already, for three generations, believed that food basically wasn't something that we talked about or thought about. We handed over the responsibility, as far as we could, to the most grown-up and sensible-looking person in a white coat. And that happened to be, at that point, Tesco, Sainsbury's and Waitrose. We're an island nation, so it was sensible for the government at any given time to take food production over because it was a strategic issue for us. But we're living, I mean, right now, the whole of our food renaissance at this moment is solely because people are starting to think, actually, like the rest of Europe, we do actually have a responsibility to think about what we eat and why we put it in our bodies. And actually, we have gone too far. We've got to try and push back. If we ever did, I mean, if we all went out this afternoon and firebombed our local supermarkets, we'd starve within 3 weeks. We can't, you know, we can't deny the fact we've got this in, we've done it, we've created it. But I think you've got to have a great deal of mindfulness about what it does and how it operates. Mm. So you can work with it, around it, roll it back. And we are winning. I mean, it's really, really tough to go and find a non-free-range egg in England these days. And that's because we all whine about it so much, and rightly so, and now it's tough. It's tough to find one. It's also put the price of eggs up. But that's another question. But it's a pretty nuanced argument.
Ben, what about your take on this? Because obviously, from the point of view of food production, from a farmer's point of view, what are the issues?
Well, I'm someone who's strangely in the middle on all of it because I'm massively on retail. Our family is a business, big on farming, but what I spend most of my time doing is the butchery, and I have a massive hand in the production. But We, with the big part of the business is the retail, and I can see it from both sides. I can see the farmer's point of view. The farmers are trying to get what they can because the prices are terrible, and the thing is, there's usually some money missing between the customer and the farmer. But also, farmers choose their vocation, and they have to sort of they deal with it, and they think, well, this is what we're going to do, and they stick with it. In my experience, customers want to know exactly where things are coming from that come into my shop. I think social media, the television, MasterChef, you name it, there's 100 new shows, social media channels, YouTube channels, articles, food bloggers popping up left, right and centre, all interested, and it all spreads the word. And I think number one for most people, overpriced a lot of the time, is actually convenience. I think if you actually went to your local shop and you actually compared prices of a pack of four potatoes to what I'd set it for in my shop, I guarantee you I'd be cheaper. In fact, if you went to buy a higher end, even middle of the range cut of meat, eggs, cake, rice, pulse, pasta, juice, you name it, I'd probably be similar, if not cheaper, because we cut out middlemen, we deal directly with suppliers, farmers and producers, and hopefully you miss out that middle. Now, supermarkets often, as we all know, they do dictate prices as a farm. Before I came on the scene, we dealt with an abattoir who specifically dealt with Tesco, and they would take the pigs. They know how much it cost you to produce the pigs. Pigs, when they're finished and ready, they have to go, and they'd say, this is what we're going to pay you, not how much are they worth. So you'd often lose, at times, £5-10 a pig, and that's crippled the nation. Now, farms have disappeared. Farms have gone. They have a value, and do you blame any farmer for cashing in and leaving? I don't. But the ones that are left, they've got a choice. We need to step up, bring it to the consumer, bring it to people, be part of the community, be a face, and actually be approachable. And the thing is, too many people think farmers sit on their farms, in their own bubble with a Range Rover and stuff, which in a lot of cases, I think you'd be very, very correct. But there's a few farmers, like myself, who I haven't got the farming way of thinking. Cambridge is infectious. Everyone knows that, who's sitting here. Cambridge has got something. The people in Cambridge, everyone comes into my shop and go, oh, but the thing is about Cambridge, people have got money. No, that's not it at all. People have got the right idea, the right attitude, the right opinion. They're willing to go out of their way to use the right businesses that they choose to use. And they're well read, they listen, they watch. And the thing is, I think that as producers, restaurateurs, and everything that all we set here, we have a right and a duty to consumers to bring it to them. I think that too many people stand back and they think, I'm an independent business, people should want to use me, which is true. A lot of people would if they could. Sometimes it's not necessarily the case. And I think that being able to bring it to the consumer more than the consumer coming to you will actually change a lot of what we're talking about today. And I think that if people can actually see you face to face, ask you exactly what goes into your food, your plastics, what you use in your production methods, it's a completely valid question. And if you can go into any establishment of mine and get me on the phone for any question you ask, you could walk into my shop tomorrow and say, can I speak to Ben about the plastics he uses? Not a problem. They ring me up and I'll speak to you. That sort of thing is missing. And I think if you have that across the board, and that's the sort of attitude we have, because people breed people in the business. It's all about people. And I think when you're face-to-face, convenience, price, attitude, it all intertwines and it all goes out the window at the same time. When you're talking to somebody that's got the right idea, it's infectious and it grips you and people listen and you get to the point and you understand a bit more about where you're spending your money. And if you think, every single time I tell my staff, if you remember what the minimum wage is in this country as a hypothetical number at the moment, 720 for over 25, if you remember that, every time someone buys their shopping, their food, they pay their bill for their tab, you divide that by the minimum wage and remember how many hours someone's had to work to buy that product from you. It's humbling, and we have a responsibility to make sure that's always perfect and brought to them.
I think we also, the other important thing for people to realise, and I think we should talk about this more and more often, is to separate the thing about price and convenience.
Spot on. Now, absolutely.
Price is kind of an absolute. I mean, there are farmers going out of business because of the price of a pig paid at the farm gate. We know that people can't afford the food, you know, to eat enough food sometimes. We also know that as a portion of our income in this country, we spend less on food than anywhere else in Europe. And having worked for 15 years in marketing, I can tell you that the biggest lie we ever managed to push on you people was that you're time poor and cash rich. The convenience argument is totally, totally fabricated. Now, at this point, somebody will always put their hands up in the audience and go, but what about the hard-pressed mum with five kids, you know, who comes home from work and hasn't got time to cook an egg? I know there are always examples of why these things are awful, and they're always heartbreaking examples, but generally speaking, most people in this country spend 10 hours a week watching utter crap on television. And these are the people that will pay more money to have the food pre-prepared for them and make it convenient. You can never sustain the argument that if you can actually peel a carrot, that, you know, carrots are too expensive. You know, you can always buy that stuff is available. Food is available, but we are being fed this utter rubbish about we haven't got time to engage with making food. And unless we get past that and start calling, particularly manufacturers and supermarkets, out on it, you know, the country that makes more ready meals than anybody else in the world, you know, way, yay us. That's one of our great contributions to the world. I'm going to be so proud when I die.
You're absolutely correct. And one phrase we all know is, if you want something done, you ask a busy person.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if it's an attitude, it's a way of life, you just get home and there's no choice, you probably cook and you do things. And I think because the choice is there, people have a choice. Convenience is one. And usually convenience has a heightened price. And how many times did we go to a petrol station that's got like an M&S in it? And you go, do you know what? If you walked out and I stopped you and I went, okay, how much was your pack of fine beans?
No idea.
And everybody knows the price of everything, the value of nothing sometimes. And at the end of the day, when that happens, is you've got to start asking yourself, well, how are you doing it? How are you bringing it to them? And what you're saying is exactly right.
I think we all communicate about food, and it's our job to do so, to try and improve the situation. I sometimes think we can't crack the money problem. No. I don't think we're going to be able to make farmers make pigs any cheaper without doing disgusting things to them.
Well, you can't.
And I don't think we're going to be able to get everybody in the world more
money
to spend on
food. Well, you're not
going
to. The fact is, the biggest problem is, and I see it with my own eyes, I'm part of a farming family, and generations, older generations of me across the board, they're all their own way. They're not open to ideas. They don't understand that actually it might cost you more to have pigs outside or on straw, technically, but what do you gain by being able to market that, to profit from that? The thing is, if you had the choice of a pig on slats or a pig on straw, £10 a pig price, you'd pick them. You'd pick £10 extra, of course you would. £20 for free range, of course you would. And that's obviously relevant to the people that sit in here. But I think if you had the person go into a supermarket and bought the lowest of the lowest quality, I bet you a surprising amount of them, if you actually presented them with the facts and said, okay, say it is more expensive. In a lot of cases, often it isn't even any more expensive. People don't even realise that. I think people would have a little bit of I would pick the one that's on straw. I just didn't know. They've got a nice picture of a meadow on the packet. How did I know it was raised indoors?
But I think because the convenience argument is created, is created by a marketing industry, and because it's cultural, because there are lots of other cultures who would look at that as an insult to actually peel my carrots for me. They would think, because that's actually something we can tackle. We may not be able to tackle the financial aspects of it and the societal aspects, but we can tackle through education and discussion the idea of convenience.
Sorry, that's what I was going to say. Is talk children from a very young age about why we should be eating good food, why we don't need to eat so much food, why are we wasting so much food?
In theory.
And if they knew more about how to create simple things from good produce, and edit at school as they do in other countries.
I think in theory that's a really good idea. And I think it just needs to be executed by someone. Like, for example, it's the parents we need to attack. I mean, if you teach a child how to cook at school, they're going to think this is great. But when they get home, mum and dad might not entertain it.
Yes, exactly.
No, this is it. And I think that there's opportunities there at the base, like you said, to try and do that, definitely.
There have been changes in school curriculum, and in theory, this is coming back in again. It was meant to come in before the coalition, or just as the coalition came in, but that was all wiped. And they've just redone the legislation. So in theory, we are going to get more teaching of children, and then hopefully that will feed into parents, but we do have at least two generations. We also have problems with house design, as odd as it sounds, because we have a lot of galley kitchens, and it's just about impossible to teach a child in a galley kitchen without hurting that child, if anyone's ever tried it. So we've got a lot of problems that are systemic in our culture that we've really got to look at hard, and people who say, I can't cook, they've never really tried, and they are the people that do actually tend to spend more on food, more on takeaways, more on convenience food instead of the good food.
To a degree, yeah.
Yeah.
Doing things for speed when we know we can jolly well construct something quite delicious, make an omelette. It takes seconds, doesn't it, to make a decent omelette. I'm speaking of someone who obviously eats too much and loves food, but I'm also guilty of waste as well, buying something because I think I want it and then not eating it straight away. And
I think teaching the whole spectrum is very important, because food is relative to just about every single thing we live and breathe for. Absolutely everything. You can relate it to anything.
But it's the basis of everything.
That's exactly it.
I'm one of three brothers, and I'm the middle-sized one. My poor mother quite early on said, no, I'm not doing the cooking, the boys are learning. I learned to roast a chicken in a foil bag at Scouts. Okay, I've got the scars to prove it. Okay, I'm as much into knife and fire as most of the people sat on this panel. Food is massively important, and to get away from wastage, to get away from children not understanding. I was really having a massive conversation with Drew from Shelford Deli, which several of you will know, about putting together a local farm where we could work with local people and say, look, bring the school kids down. Here's an orchard. This is where an apple comes from. Getting the old PBI apple orchards going again, and kind of saying, look, there's about 20 different varieties, not the two you see in Tesco's. To go, no, here is a chicken. No, you want the chicken for dinner? Right, not a problem. And getting on with it. That's where luckily my godson, his mother is quite brutal like that, and we'll teach him how to butcher a pig and chickens and bits and pieces. And I think that's massively important across the board, but it's got to be done, as Ben said, with us as the foodies with the businesses going to those people and having a talk. Yeah, the biggest talks I do are for the WI. And the reason I do them is because I've got the lady of the household. If you've got the lady of the household, 90% of the time, you've got the household. Okay? They do the cooking, they do the organising, they know what's going on. I'm being honest, sorry.
Yeah. When you say about the showing them the farming, the process, the growth, I mean, it's that's what's actually infectious. I mean, when I'm down the farm and I've seen the animals, I've butchered them, and then it's infectious, and you feel that, and I'm no different to anybody else. It's just that I'm in that, you know. And you can see how it can rub off on people, and you see how people have just go and do run-of-the-mill jobs, and then suddenly a food job just takes them away from everything. And they go, do you know what I mean? This is absolutely what I want to do, and it just engrosses you. And all day, all you do is I go around supermarkets and I have a look what they've got, and I have a little snoop round, and my wife's like, come on, Ben, I've got to look at this. And I can't help myself, you know. And I want to see what they're doing. How much per kilo? You know, and you almost want to stand at the door with leaflets. But a massive thing is like you were saying, starting people off, we're always happy. This is something we do in the shop regularly, and it's sort of naturally grown into this. I didn't start doing it. People came in and go, all right, so you've got a farm. So, okay, what about this? Tell me about this. And you're like, oh, okay, sure. And before you know it, everyone wants to know, and you're just a bit surprised. Before you know it, you're sat on a panel like this. You can't believe people want to know what you know. You just talk about and waffle on it all day.
I think to bring it back to the original question, which is, do people care about the story, or are they just after convenience, or are they being led by the pocket? People do care about the story, and the big boys know that as well, because you've got people like Sav Miller who are buying up what were independent, I thought that might make you make that face. Sam Miller, who are buying up small independent craft beers, they're launching their own craft beers, and they're creating a narrative that surrounds them. Tesco are doing it with their farm-labelled produce, isn't it? I mean, it's seen a farm in the sort of...
Yeah. And they were caught out, weren't they?
They were
making up farm names, but yeah. I'll be unfair to my partner. She came home going, look, mate, done in Cambridge. And I went, you won't find Redmere Farms anywhere near here. And that name will change in 2 weeks. Yeah. Which she felt gutted about, that she'd been duped by a company she trusts.
Well, that's the point, you know.
People
do care about the story. It's just that we have to make sure that our story is better than theirs.
And follow it.
Truthful.
Yeah.
And true.
It's true, but we've also got a great insider sitting next to you.
But I think one of the biggest parts of what you're saying is being approachable. Like, for example, we're all here today, and everyone's an expert in their field. And I think everyone also has a broad knowledge of what's outside of their field, too, by the looks of it. And I think the thing is being approachable is a really, really big part of it. And if we can be approachable to anybody and answer questions frankly, politician ums and ahs, you know, just really get down to the nitty-gritty. If people want to know, we'll tell them. And that's, I think, when people get an air of honesty and trust, that's as simple as that. And if things go wrong, people trust you that you forget someone's order, like the piece of paper went missing, they trust you, they go, yeah, sure, bring it next time. I know, you know, and because they know you.
You tell a vegetarian that you can't drink their cask beer and they've got the pint in their hand, the look of shock on their face. But it's only a really small amount. Oh, right then, okay. Suddenly the vegetarianism goes out the window.
It's like there's an eyeball floating.
You know, tasty. And then they're delighted when you do something else. But yeah, be honest and straight with them. And
that's all. That's all people want. Mm-hmm.
Using social media to achieve these aims, because I don't know if you've spent, if anyone of you on the panel have spent a lot of time with, for instance, year 9s or year 10s, and seen how a lot of the things that they hold dear and important come from social media, and how that's kind of the current way that people will engage with things. So I was just wondering, how do you use that to...
Spread
a message about your food and where
widow.
It comes from and things like that.
My wife is a social media widow. My battery doesn't last 5 minutes. All I do is Twitter, Facebook, pictures. And it's not only that, it's trying to build up everything else so people can get an idea for who you are and what you're trying to tell them. And it's a really good way of doing that. It's very interesting about year 9s and 10s because they're the next step. But quite often, I've noticed with a lot of my customers is the parents are a certain kind of people, and usually the children are a certain kind of people as well. And if you've got a lot of people interested in food, farming and production, there's a very, very good chance their children will be. So in a way, it's quite difficult to target the ones that the parents aren't interested. Because if everybody remembers, if your dad come and helped you with your homework when you were a kid, it was a subject you were good at, you know? And if you had a problem and you went to your mum, she'd help you sort it out. Now, when you're left to do things on your own, it's a double-edged sword. Sometimes you do it on your own, don't you, as a child? But generally, it's the pushing, the support and the help from your parents. I do think parents are a massive target for the next generation. I teach them everything. They come down the farm. My son adores the combine harvester, and he gets sort of an inherent sort of love for it that you are born into. And I know that's very, very unique, and I don't understand not everyone has that opportunity. But there is the opportunity to talk to anybody like us that runs an independent shop. Can my son come and watch you cut up a pig? He would love to. Of course he can. Or would you mind him just coming and tasting your whatever you made? And I think that little things like that will imprint on people's memories. And I think if we can really focus on the next generation where possible, I think it's everything to gain. It's just being able to get in there. It's just, there's no clear way in.
But in getting that other generation, I got asked by a local college to have work experience. And I said, yeah, not a problem. Please come. Okay, it's a brewery. We have chemicals. We've got hot water. We've got trip hazards. You've got a moody brewer. You've got the usual things.
So I hope you hate your child.
But I said, that's fine. But they wanted Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. Not to be rude, who on this panel works Monday to Friday, 9 to 5? Yeah?
Not in the food industry, you know.
Yeah? And I said, no, I'm quite happy to have them in Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, but look, Wednesday we're going to start at 8, we're going to finish at 6, we can keep them fed and watered, no problem at all, done. But then give them Thursday off. Oh, no, they can't, because then we have to look after them at school. Is there not a bit of flexibility? They were more worried about their backsides and the right way of the education than the actual education of the child.
This goes back to full circle.
There's something bigger than this about social media, and I think this is a really, really fascinating question. Because actually, it's not just about... I mean, obviously, when you're my age, everything looks like a question of age, particularly social media. But actually, you know, 10 years ago, like most food writers, I would have sat in a room and I would have agreed with you that everything in food in the end boils down to politics. It's all politics in the end, and it's all about money in the end. And actually, as I get older, I realise that politics is a pretty tiny part of it, and what it's actually about is society, media control, and marketing. Now, one of the really interesting things about social media is that's the first time those barriers to entry in those areas have broken down. So actually, if we are going to... We can try and legislate so more people have more money to spend on sensible food, or we can legislate to drive food prices down. Or, if we really want to tackle problems around things like this convenience culture or people being unable to cook, we've suddenly got ownership of the media, publicly, ourselves, for the first time since we have mass media. So actually, I'm fascinated by what's going on Twitter. Two nights ago, I was at Fortnum & Mason Awards for food communicators, food writers, food media people. Last 10 years, 5 years I've gone along to that event, it's been fat white blokes, mainly, and posh white women. And we would all sit around and talk about agreeable clarets and that kind of thing. This time, most of the awards are going to people in their early 20s of a massive degree of cultural backgrounds, so-and-so, yeah, she was a food blogger. Yeah, no, he's I don't even know what a vlogger is, for Christ's sake. I met a vlogger the other day. But this is, so, you know, and these guys are taking over the food media that's helped to cause a lot of these problems that we fondly think might be the answer. Well, you know, sadly, the big prize at the end was a choice between Jamie's food fight and Hugh's fishy fighting thing. Oh, what a tired, sad way of looking at it. Two bored programs by bored old men. But actually, what it really is about is now, I mean, I do admit there's a worrying number of these people that are taking over the food media through blogging, who are doing it through some very odd ideas of body dysmorphia and clean eating. It's a very, very middle class thing. But then the whole media has been that for a long time, and we can crack through this. We can move on. But sometimes I feel like completely like a blind man in the dark with this stuff. And I use social media I'm a Hootsuiter. I've got, you know, 14,000 people following me any given time. I love this stuff. And even I feel like I'm blundering around and I've no bloody idea what's going to happen next, because it really is Wild West. But when that happens, I think we can get a lot of this stuff. But we've got to look at these things actually as social and communicative problems, and not just, I mean, it is true we should teach kids how to cook in schools. But also to go, yeah, it's a government problem, let them deal with it. Or let's just tax people more. Those are no longer just the answers. It's a media thing as well. And we can do it the first time we've ever been able to do that. I think it can be so powerful. So yeah, keep asking the question. Ask it again next year and the next year, and actually, well, internet years. There's 8 internet years to every human year, apparently. So ask it in another 6 weeks and keep bloody hammering at it.
But it's once again about having that approach, being available.
Yeah.
But you can be tweeted, and if you want to respond to it, it comes to your phone or your computer, and it's also instant access. You can usually work out what someone's doing or how someone is by their Twitter feed. Generally, and you go, oh, do you know what? I'm interested in that today. I'm just going to have a quick look on Twitter, and suddenly, before you know it, you have actually got that access for people if they want to find. Obviously, people have to find you, so it's like minded at the moment, but it's about sort of making it a bit more sort of obvious, I suppose.
We've got another question over here, I believe.
It was more a point to kind of add to what people are saying with the whole social media, the likes of sort of Facebook or Twitter. When you've got a brand, it's almost like it's, I think it's less of the story so much as feeling like you know them, you're involved, it's personable, and then you sort of share that, you know what they're doing, oh, they're running a competition, they're doing that. So you become closer to them through that way. You share them and with other people you know, you go, I know, I really like this. But I have also seen a change in supermarkets. Those brands that you see at food markets and things, they are more and more increasing on the supermarket shelves because people are interested in it, because it's sharing and it is changing.
But it changes. It does change so fast. About 8 internet years to every human year. And actually, in the last 3 months, very, very publicly, the supermarkets have caught up with this idea that they want a farmer's face, some lovely old rubicund chap with wrinkles and a bit bald on top and twinkly eyes. They want a black and white shot of him and the name of a farm. So they'll fake it until we stop them faking it. They'll do it because they can get away with it. What they can't fake right now is that there are some farmers who are twittering from their combines. You know, if you want to know something about what he said, you Twitter the bloke. You know, you can't fake that kind of stuff. And it's actually, the dialogue becomes more important.
Just got to look at the rows and then they've been tweeting. I've done it. I've been going, oh.
On social media, I find I have from nothing to 3 accounts in 18 months. And it's only this week I found the rest of this panel. Okay, Alex. Known on Twitter for a while, but I still feel like a complete freak or a fraud going, oh look, it's a really interesting day brewing. It's not interesting enough, but then I can follow other people and I think, oh wow, it's a really good shot of you had the salmon rushdie dish from this week.
Yes.
I sat there and thought, that is an amazing green, what the heck is he up to? And it's finding the interest and what works for you. Yeah, I am a Luddite, I'm a welder, a brewer, you know, hammers and spanners and bicycles, that's me. But some people will see some of my photos and go, wow, that's a really nice weld you've got there. Or, oh, have you got a size 7/16 spanner? Oh, that's really interesting. It's finding the right people in the right way. And getting out there, I think, is the key for that social
that's
media.
That's the really exciting thing for us. I mean, at the Hole in the Wall, we have a Twitter account and an Instagram account. I have a personal email account, Instagram account, Twitter account. And what it means is that we can engage with people before they come to dinner. Mm. And we can continue the experience after they've gone home. Previously, people would come through the door, they would have their dinner, they'd be with us for 2 or 3 hours. We can now increase the anticipation of that, and we can increase the extent which they stay with us. And I think that's really exciting.
You encourage customers to like photograph their food, for example.
It's not something that we actively encourage or discourage. I know, but people have fairly strong views about photography in restaurants.
Yeah.
And, you know, I see pictures of the food that I cook go out sometimes, and I think, oh, God, it looks terrible. But it's just a case of lighting. Please tell me.
Let them some lights.
You know, the temptation to set up a light box in the corner. Yeah, if you wish to photograph your food, please.
I spoke to a person once, so this is mainly for Facebook, and he was saying he works for quite a large company. He goes, well, I Monday morning I schedule all my posts. So I do this and I do this and I do this. And I thought, that's a really nice idea, and I think a foundation for your page might be a good idea, but I find I like the natural flow, and I can tell a natural flowing page. Mm. 3 posts together because I found 3 good things in a row. Sometimes scheduling doesn't quite work. And I think when you're looking at someone's account and you go, that you want to know that whoever you're following doing the tweeting, doing it, and it makes you feel more connected. If you think it's an automatic retweet or something, but you're trying to, trying to get, I'm trying to tag you in on a tweet or something, that just goes retweet. You think, I actually retweet quite fast, so maybe that's the case. But I think people like that connection, that you can tweet anybody, the most famous, your biggest idols in the planet, and you might just get tweeted, and that's actually quite cool. Mm. And I think that is really something that you can work with, that sort of anticipation. Goes, if I tweet them, I might just get a response for that, and maybe people might enjoy that.
Question four, when you were talking about sort of the fake farmer on the supermarkets, food and stuff, but that's not just limited to a supermarket. That also happens in social media and on artisanal shops as well. Like, they buy the potatoes and then they secretly put earth on it so they can bump up the price and then sell it as a healthier option. So how would you stop that as well from not only happening in supermarkets but from the fake people in social media trying to ruin...
I think by questioning them. You can rumble somebody. If you ask someone enough questions about their trade, you can find out if they know what they're on about or not. I mean, I don't know. No one knows everything about their trade. I learn something, one or more, every single day. I had no idea anything, all the time. And anyone who says, I know everything that needs to know about it, then you know they're not on about it, There's days where I go, why did I do that? Why did I do that? But the fact of the matter is, things like, if someone says to you, they put dirt on potatoes to bump the price up, I can tell you now that's wrong because, for example, dirty potatoes are always cheaper. They haven't had to be mushed, for a start. That's just, I grow potatoes. We grow 10, 20 acres a year. We all just, which we sell for the shop and things. So there's a lot of that going on. A lot of people jump on the bandwagon. Now, something we always had a problem as a farm shop was that we were expensive before people walked in the door. And also you had the problem nationwide spread that farm shops were plonked on farms by a farmer who managed to borrow enough money against his land to convert the barn and stick someone in it. And they're not necessarily farm shops. They might be on a farm, but they are not actual farmers. And now, when you go into a shop and you've got someone and you go, do you have any of this? And they go, and you know there's no link to the farm there. And you might as well not have bothered. You might as well have gone to Tesco and you probably would have had a farm assured something or other there because they do have assurances. The quality in supermarkets does vary, but generally they have the assurances in place so that as a consumer you do get a higher quality product than you would have done 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. Slaughtering's hugely regulated, things like this. So as a customer in this country, you do have such a high standard from the start. So you have the choice, but that's the thing. I think you can approach things with a certain... Do some research if you're interested, and don't try and catch people out, but you better see things that you'll know, well, actually, there's a lot of different things here from different farms. They haven't got their own farm, perhaps, and stuff like that. If that's what you're interested in, you might find that that's the angle to go for.
I'll put my hand up to this. I do consult with supermarkets and have that at various points, usually with their marketing teams around the kind of communication they do. So I'm talking to them about how they write about stuff more than anything else. But it's... Jay Rayner wrote a very interesting book a couple of years ago on this, where he actually went and spoke to the supermarkets when he started to realise that our supply chains in the UK were such that we couldn't live without them anyway. Yeah. We've got to live with them, so how are we going to do it? And he couldn't find anybody truly evil in a supermarket either. I mean, they don't all get around a table first thing on a Monday morning and go, right, how are we going to screw the customers over this time then? What can we do to really
rip off? It's just escalated out of control.
It's actually, all they're really interested, they're really boring. Because the only thing they're really interested in is a kind of absolutely rigorous spreadsheet thing. Mm-hmm. And the spreadsheet thing means that if you can sell more of something because more people want it, at a price at which they can afford to do it, it will work. And some of the bad stuff that goes through on that basis, but it isn't done to plan to be evil. And so it's a sort of odd one, really. I mean, I can't help thinking, education is always the answer. And this is why I think new media are so interesting, because it now means that education is not about just being done in schools. It's about the dialogue. It's what they used to call the discourse. We're now part of this. It's a horrible term to have to use, but we're part of a discourse. We're all part of it. We're actually part of what educates kids now. Mm. Every time you go out there and you Twitter and you might be being followed by somebody, you're part of the educational process. Actually, far more than is going on in schools in some cases. So if we're helping with that, we've got a responsibility to get people asking. And supermarkets, in the end, boring though it may sound, just do what we want them to do and we'll pay them to do.
That's exactly right. I mean, yeah. if everyone probably thinks the biggest selling meat in a supermarket is chicken, and I've got a master butcher who I've worked with who's 70, he's late 70s, and he said to me, oh boy, we never used to have chicken. Chicken was Christmas, right? And chicken is the example I'm using, but I'm sure there's hundreds we can name. Something that used to be the product that we couldn't afford, couldn't have, it was a special product, becomes suddenly the norm because people crave the product. So they really want chicken. So what do supermarkets do? They find, well, consumers find a way of making, it's a market. So we wanted the product, someone went out of their way and created that product. Mm. Now chicken's the most common meat that we eat probably in this country. Maybe bacon and things, pork, but besides. But if you think of just a whole piece of meat, which is a rarity for a lot of people to buy these days, most people would probably recall recently buying a whole chicken or chicken breast or a chicken leg or whatever. And they've made something that was sought after, was a special product, now the norm. And it could probably happen with anything that's a special product.
High hop beers. The UK is much better known for its malting barley, very traditional earthy hops. But who here hasn't had 4.5% American IPA with loads of hops in it? I'm absolutely with I'm bored of it. Because we've got better things in this country, but that's what's cheap at the supermarket. It's easily got holdable. We can all name the top three big breweries that do it. When was the last time you all drank a stout? Yeah? Or drank an old porter or a Kolsch or an Alt or any of these other thousands of ranges of beers? No. But then everybody comes to me going, oh, I want your IPA. It's not worth me brewing an IPA. My water's naff for IPAs. My hops aren't right. But it's that thing of, oh, but that's what they want. That's what people will get. The demand is driven, but that also creates some of the wide boys, playboys of the industry going, oh well, you know, we'll brew this, that's what people want. The beer's not very good, but it's got the right label, it's got the right name, it's got the right media backing. Hey presto, you've got a new brewery.
Well, I suppose a bit like supermarkets as well, the lager trade is a massive example of what you're talking about, because I used to, well, I still have hand in it, but our business owns a pub and I've been up to my eyeballs in it for some time. And you'll speak to the companies and they'll talk to you off the record and have a good chat with you. And basically everyone knows extra cold lagers, the colder and colder and colder. And obviously if anyone who has respected and enjoyed a good quality real ale knows, a cold real ale has no flavour. So all they're doing is they're actually making, this is what the man told me anyway, the quality of the lager is actually becoming less important. They're driving the fact that people want the cold versions of these and trying to make out that's what people want. And then people go, yeah, I do want the cold version. The quality of the lager goes down because it doesn't taste, you can't taste it as much the colder and colder it gets. So before you know it, Guinness extra cold, John Smith's extra cold, and all these things prop in.
Make an ice cream.
Yeah, you can make an ice cream. But I remember once I had a local brewer I dealt with and he had some bottles of mild, which I really like bottles of mild, I only thought 3.6. And I made the mistake, without realising, I popped it in the fridge and I forgot about it. I was like, oh, I'll have that one day. Poured it out and I was like, this doesn't taste right. But then my cellar's 12 degrees in the pump, which is, I'm assuming, is that correct? Optimum temperature, 11 to 13, I was always told. But whatever. And because it has to taste, it's like in the restaurant, you wouldn't send anything out piping. Because you go, can't taste it. How often more than not do you carve up your roast meal at the weekend? Enjoy it, then you go back for that second bit. And it tastes so much better when you carve it off. Because when you let things, the meats rest, the fibres, they relax and the flavour comes, but also your mouth can cope with it. And it's all how it's driven. And I think that supermarket's an example of what you were saying, the lager producer, they jump on a bandwagon of what somebody wants and then they then dictate how it progresses in some sense.
But this is where it's changing and it's actually good news for us. Because actually the whole idea that manufacturers can create need for product is an idea that's advertising mediated by mainstream mass media. So it's only been since Don Draper first put on his smart suit on Madison Avenue that it's actually been possible for anybody to consider we can change the way people behave, we can make them put something in their face and light it, and then we can sell millions and millions of them once we've got them addicted. We can sell brown syrup in a tin and make people so addicted to the caffeine that they'll drink millions of gallons of it, even though it costs us almost nothing to manufacture. Those days are actually past. because we are undermining daily the mass media. And so what's really intriguing when you start getting around the micro, I mean, breweries are a fantastic case study because some of the biggest marketing evils imaginable have been perpetrated on one level. I see that Budweiser are renaming them their beer America for the forthcoming Olympics. They actually had to legislate so they could continue to call it beer, because of course it isn't beer, it's made of rice and half a dozen other flavourings, mainly caramel. But at the same time, there are breweries that exist solely because they discuss with an audience of interested people globally, because you can get a global audience together now through the new media, that they were interested in a particular kind of thing, and they grow that interest. So we're sort of winning.
Any contribution by someone credible. I mean, if someone follows yourself and they listen to all your shows and what you do, and you retweet something or whatever that contradicts what they think, they will then take a second to go, hold on a minute, I'll look into that. And that's all it takes. I think everyone's actually a lot more open-minded than they give themselves credit for. And I think that you don't even realise it because you have your routines and you do what you normally do. But if I see something prop up in front of me, I go, actually, that's a really interesting point. And I think something as simple as that sort of way, taking control of the media one person at a time.
I think the other thing it's doing is also decentralising the way all that production is happening. Definitely. And with the kind of maker movement at the moment, a lot of food production is actually happening at home. And I think social media is a great way to kind of teach people, encourage people, connect people who have the same interests.
I think everyone probably is sick of hearing the Great British Bake Off. But all I've heard for the last few years is I deliver office boxes and things like this, and they'll say, oh, well, I don't need as much fruit today because we're having a bake-off. And everyone's baking at home. And now everyone can make a cake. People come in the shop and they buy eggs. I'm making a cake today, more than ever. And all it takes is one thing that people see to go, I'm going to have a go at that. And then they realise it's so easy to make a... to make a cake, or they watch MasterChef and say, actually, that there's some really intricate things there, but the foundations are usually quite simple. The flavour's there. It's really how it's, you know, how it's the extra level that gets to be complicated, isn't it? And I think that all it takes is things like that, like you were saying, that you can change people's perceptions and having a go.
Yeah, and giving tools and, you know, providing recipes and showing
and
how
we've
to
got,
do it.
We've got the opportunity in this day and age, the technology is at its height. Everything anyone can have. I mean, I was just thinking the other day, we've got these fan-assisted ovens, how people like used to make cakes without them. You know, I had a gas oven at the restaurant, and I used to put cakes in it and go, I don't like that, that's rubbish. So then I put them in like a nice fan-assisted one, it's all consistent and stuff. But then you think, there's times where they just wasn't there, and you think, everyone's got the opportunity. And tools are cheaper than ever, and you can buy whatever you need to do whatever, I suppose. Yeah.
So can I just ask Tim, in relation, to food DIY, because you've written quite a lot on this, and also ask Vivaya, what about making your own 3D printed food? Is that going to be one of the
amazing
next type of food DIY things, do you think?
I've seen a fair number of experiments in this area, and I find it fascinating. I think it's wonderful that technology is being used, but what we're actually doing here is largely changing substance and texture of existing food. What I'm really waiting for is the day we can photocopy food and indeed fax it, because that would be great. So do me 200 copies of that burger, and we'll send it somewhere in India, and then we're really starting to get somewhere with it.
So what you want is a replicator.
I want a replicator. I totally want a replicator. If we can get that to molecular level first. I think there were different things. I mean, I think the idea about food DIY was really just trying to get people to have a go at the production methods in some kind of amateurish, whatever, however you could do it. Just do it. Don't worry about how beautiful it's going to be, because everything was about the perfect this and the perfect that. This is all about get some salt, get some pork, make some bacon. It might not be as great as the bacon from your butchers. I really hope it isn't, because actually, you know, we need good butchers to make good bacon. But have a go, and the one thing that will happen is you will then buy better bacon, because you'll never, ever, ever accept the crap that pees out all that horrible fishy water that comes out from rubbish bacon. Do it once, that's fine. And it can't be that complicated, because 99% of the population of the world are actually doing this stuff in mud huts, you know, in other places. So let's try. And it was really, like everything I do, sort of couched in some kind of vaguely 1970s Trotskyite notions of taking over the means of production. So it was all about that. And I think 3D, I think, is a tremendous opportunity. And I'm really excited that anybody at all, is choosing to mash things together and make them operate. The thing that's really Cambridge that I love more than anything else, and you learn it when you arrive, and I've only been here 5 years, and I've only recently learned it, is it's very much like the fashion industry, in the sense that you go to a fashion show and you see clothes and you think, I could never possibly wear that, but I'm really interested that the designer did it, because it's going to affect what I wear next year. And, you know, my mum is going to have a 3D printer in the kitchen this week. I'm pretty sure about that. But can you imagine if brains like this are working on stuff like that, what we might have in a few years down the line that might really make a difference? I think it's much more exciting even as that.
So the way we're looking at it at the moment is we're using real ingredients and we using it as a tool to play with food. Yes. So it's understanding the food, understanding the provenance, and creating that link between digital and physical.
I think it's a fantastic idea. I think it could really, really work. I think that people who don't cook or don't try to put things together are usually afraid of it, but if they could have that taken care of for them in some senses, I think it would be a massive eye-opener to a lot of people. It wouldn't try, if you could do it in such a way that people would do things they wouldn't normally do as well, it might open their eyes up to a lot more than ever before.
I love your idea of a strawberry sphere with some cream inside. That sounds absolutely incredible.
The self-creaming strawberry.
Yeah.
It's the Raspberry Pi generation, but working the opposite way to food. Yes. You know, we've come in from fire, knives, scouts, playing in the mud and working out we need to eat as well. You're taking it from the Raspberry Pi, can use the technology that, not to be rude, most of us are probably struggling with, and going, right, it can also print food. Sorry, what? Oh, wait. Yeah, that's going to get them excited. You know, I've got mates who are working the Raspberry Pi, and the digital printing, the robots they work with, and things. But they also get ecstatic about the food writers and bits and pieces. And you sit there and think, oh, okay, it's just a different approach.
Have you come across the BrewBot?
Yes. Yes.
Should we tell them about the BrewBot?
No. I've only roughly come across it, but the understanding is that you have the capacity from pretty much your phone or any piece of mobile technology to dial up your homebrew system at home and go click. And by the time you get home off your holiday, you've got fresh brewed beer there.
Scary.
Which to me is a little bit backwards and everything else, and I question what is in it and everything else. But if that gets you into good beer and off Anheuser-Busch and off the poor produced, mass-produced rubbish lager, and it gets you going, oh, hold on, what's this grain? You know, and it gets you talking to Marianne about sustainability of grains and why that's important, and looking at local hop yards and looking at local food. And if that's the interest, fine. If that's the way the 3D printer takes you, fine.
I interviewed the guys who came up with this at their Kickstarter, and the thing that struck me about this is one of these classic tech mashups that it absolutely lights me up when these things happen, because it just changes the way you think about these things. So basically, the brewing process, which can be quite simple, and this machine is about the size of a small fridge. It's got stainless steel pots inside it. One of the things that's changed amateur brewing, which used to be an awful thing that your dodgy uncle did under the stairs, is that now you can get yeasts and hops from all over the world via this internet thing, fresh and vacuum-packed and tiny. So I can literally have some, you know, a small pouch of Czechoslovakian hops and a small pouch of hops from somewhere in Kent, and I can mix those together and make my own flavour of beer. I've got the temperature control and everything else. So this machine puts that all together. That in itself is nice, and a lot of, you know, posh advertising agencies in California built them so that they could make their own IPA, and they thought that was going to be terribly cool. And then somebody else thought what a really good idea it was, that because on the side of it it's got an iPad and you type in the quantities of materials that you're making for your brew, then if I make an IPA and it's a particularly good one, I then put on the community that's attached to it, I put that recipe up there and you can download it to your BrewBot. Now, the odd thought about that is it then makes with everything else controlled by the system, it suddenly makes it this weird thing. Well, it's exactly what happened with music and iTunes. Mm. The sudden ability to actually mean that you still put in the raw materials, but the IP, the intellectual property, becomes part of the community thing. Yeah. You know, and you pimp my beer. You know, because I think this IPA is good, but you do, you know, try it with the different hops, see how it goes. That stuff mashes together. You pull together a community of brewers, effectively Brewers know more about beer than anybody else, so they can also solve each other's problems. Their opinions on beer are pretty damn good. So if half a dozen guys start making this stuff instead of just one, you think that's a good one. You know, those things start, you can even start building algorithms over the top of them to tell you why one beer is good and might recommend another one for you. And suddenly you've got Amazon of beer or Google of beer. I mean, it's insane what that. Now, actually, it's too expensive. It's £3,000 a unit. It's too big. It's silly. It's no fun. And you can do it in a plastic bucket. And why wouldn't you? Because there are people out there at the moment making beers in plastic buckets that are winning brewing competitions all over the world. Really, really good stuff that are making the big brewers sit up and take note. But when you think about that, it's not, what's going on inside your head is not just strawberries and cream inside it. It's the possibility of where that then takes the mashing up across the industry. And with 8 internet years to every human year, that's, you know, we could be talking next week that it's spitting out a cheese sandwich out of my laser printer. I'm not saying it won't.
We have a question over here.
This is a mashup, if you like, staying with the Great British Bake Off and with social media and moving perhaps away from digital food production to the science of nutrition. I had a question for Dr. Marianne Hart about something Tim mentioned, which was kind of hashtag clean eating. There was been an argument between Ruby Tando from the Great British Bake Off and the Hemsley sisters, was it?
Yeah. Or
about clean eating. And I was wondering, given the book that you've written on carbohydrates and your interest in food nutrition education, what you make of all of that?
I would rather have things less processed in terms of what we're actually eating. My particular interest is actually in dietary fibre. So the more fibre in things, the better it is. And the work that I did, it was actually with Public Health England, where we were looking at what is good for you, what isn't good for you in terms of carbohydrate intake. What we found was that there's you need quite a high level, actually, of dietary fibre, higher than we're eating at the moment, to decrease the risk of the long-term illnesses such as type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease and everything else. And so you really need to be looking at whole grains, fruit and vegetables, local if possible, and having these in your diet rather than the highly processed food. So that's my feeling, rather than, yeah.
But with that, the clean eating, which, if I'm perfectly honest, I've ignored entirely being a brewer and a meat eater. But the roughage and the fibre content, a lot of people come to me and get really surprised I bottle my own beer at the brewery. Yep. But the reason I do that is because I've spent time on filters, I've spent time on pasteurisers, and I know the stripping out of flavours you'll do on beer, but I also know chemically what you're stripping out structurally. Yep. And I know people come and drink my beer and go, oh, that's got some mouthfeel and some body to it, and it'll take on a good curry or, you know, whatever you're eating. It's because we're so used to this highly processed, supermarket stabilised, it's got to last 18 months, 2.3% beer. Whereas if I say, look, there's a 9.5% Belgian brown that I brew once a year, it'll go well with beef or it'll go well with pork. People sit there and go, ooh. And they'll go to the local supermarket or the local veg shop, they'll go whatever and get that roughage in, and suddenly the whole meal takes another weight on, and they're not having three portions, they're having one.
Yes.
And suddenly that little bit of beer, which is bad for us, is suddenly hopefully turning a little bit better. I'm not going to say that too loudly.
Well, no, that's entirely, I mean, that is actually entirely true. It's all about balance. It's not about eating too much of one thing and one thing's going to solve everything. It's about, I mean, I do get a bit, because I like my dietary fibre and it's my, I spend far too long thinking about it and studying it. It's something I talk about a lot, but it is all, food is all about balance. It's about having a range of foods from different sources, and it is, it's looking at how things are produced. It's, if you like, the molecular gastronomy, it's understanding the science of the food, what it actually does. And this has been known for a very long time, but it's whether or not it's been put into terms that people use, but it's understanding all of that.
Yeah, I think this is important. The first thing I will say, if you haven't read Ruby Tando's article on Vice magazine, I suggest you go away and do so, because it is brilliant, it's prescient, it's really important, and it's very, very well written.
So, sorry, can you tweet that later for us?
I tweeted it yesterday.
Oh, right, I missed it, sorry.
You didn't go back far enough down my timeline. Okay. In terms of the clean eating thing, this ties in quite neatly, actually, with the nature of this debate. The number of people, there's three or four people, we all know who they are, who are at the top of this apex of clean eating, and they are very loud, they're very vocal, and they are very influential. talking about the science of it, what's important when it comes to science is peer-reviewed evidence. Mm-hmm. And what we've got is some very, very loud people who have nothing more than anecdotal evidence. Yep. And they are shouting far, far too loudly, and there's far too many people listening to them.
They've completely altered the face of food publishing over the last couple of years. So they're outselling every other kind of recipe book by a factor of 10. Now, the thing that's most intriguing about this, of course, is that there's the dirty secret amongst those of us who write food books. And this is the reason I declared to myself a year ago that I'd never write another book with a recipe in it, is that even the best-selling cookbooks these days, you're lucky if people will cook one recipe from the book. It is really, that's not the way people engage with food books and food media. Mostly if they want recipes, they go online. So people are consuming them for a different reason. There are all kinds of lifestyle reasons why people would buy my book, to put it on their coffee table, or to, like, they like to enjoy reading and feeling that, you know, this is the kind of thing they might do if they ever had time to do it, or something along those lines. But I'm not kidding myself, people read those recipes. Now actually, it is looking at the moment from research that even less recipes are engaged with from the clean eating books. You know, it's 1 in 10, but that's not what the books are for. And so actually when you start looking at this, and this goes across all food writing and all media, food media, the publishers are having a real problem with getting their heads around this, is what exactly are they for? What do they reflect about our beliefs about ourselves and about the society we live in? And it's not actually just about what we put in our bodies, it's about so much more than just food. Mm. And that's kind of odd, and nobody can quite work out what the answers are to that. I mean, I know that the business between Ruby and the Hemsleys is getting really ugly, but the reason it's doing so is that there's so much support for what Ruby's saying amongst the food media. Editors want to hear that. They've been waiting so long for someone to take down the Hemsleys, and the science is just so obvious to knock them out with. It's going to get uglier and uglier. But equally, Ruby doesn't come from this from an unnuanced position herself. I mean, she's got a huge history of eating disorders, which she's been very public about. And this area is the awful thing about this, you know, is it's a really, really ugly public business, and it's got bugger all to do with food. It's couched in food, but it's not actually about people sitting down and eating things. Mm. It's about what they're saying about what they eat, about what they want to believe about what they eat, what they want to believe about the control they have over their own lives and their own bodies. It's actually got comparatively little to do with a lot of the stuff that we regard as food.
It's more food worries than anything else, which is probably not justified in a large number of cases. No. Right. I think we will be sort of rounding up shortly and I will be asking the panel, what do you think, therefore, are going to be some of the latest fashions in food, perhaps related to Cambridge or just perhaps in general? So, Vivi, if I ask you first.
Well, I have to say 3D printing, of course.
3D printing, thank you. Yes. And when are we going to be able to purchase our own kitchen top 3D food printer?
Hopefully this summer.
Summer, fantastic.
Yeah, we've been working on the latest version, so it should be.
Wow.
Look at the excitement.
Brilliant. Tim, what about you?
Increasing casualisation, definitely. I think we're moving into an environment where we're catching up with the rest of Europe. Mm. You know, more people are going to be eating out more often, more regularly, and I think it's an incredibly exciting time for Cambridge. Because it was stuck behind the curve for quite a long time, and it suddenly caught up with unbelievable speed. Mm-hmm. Things are moving at an incredible rate of knots, and one can wring one's hands and bemoan the fact that even more chains are coming into town. And I don't give a great round of applause to anybody who's coming in and opening up that way, but they're only doing it because they're not stupid, they're not evil. What they're looking at is, actually, this place is full of foodies, people who love food. Mm-hmm. And there's a few bob to be made, and I can't honestly blame them. So they're coming here because there's a lot more independence, and they're coming here because there's a lot more foodies, and I can't say either of those things are bad. So great, good news all round.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's just a really exciting time to be cooking in Cambridge. We are getting busier and busier. It's been, once again, terrific to be part of the Eat Cambridge Festival and seeing how it's grown over the last 3 years. Seeing it was Sunday night, used to be the night that I would try and find some sushi somewhere. I'd spend the whole week cooking heavily reduced sauces and spend Sunday cooking roast dinner. The last thing I wanted was a beef sandwich on a Sunday afternoon.
And that, those yeah, must be great left, left surface. Yeah.
I'll wait till Monday though. But, and now you can go into the centre of town. There's four sushi restaurants within 100 metres of each other. It's absolutely, you know, as you say, there's positives and negatives. The overall effect is hugely, overwhelmingly positive. I think it's just an absolute privilege to be cooking in Cambridge at the moment, and long may it continue.
What about you, Ben?
Well, again, agree. I mean, Cambridge is an amazing place. We hope to carry on trading here for forever. And I absolutely love Cambridge. It's always there's always a close place to my heart. I mean, I grew up around here. But we've thought this as a business for a long time. We are hoping to expand in Cambridge. And I'm hoping to be part of the trend. One of the trends we want to promote is everything we've been talking about today. And we're hoping to bring some more farm shops around Cambridge in the next year or two to give everybody the new trend of a quality local convenience store where you can buy proper food when you need it, round the corner, tied to a farm, tied to a person, so you know where it comes from. That doesn't exist. Well, and Cambridge, if I know anything, is the place to do it. Everybody has 100% interest in it. Our shop has just grown and grown, and I have just so many customers, and then I get invited to things like this, you know. Obviously, people are interested in it. So we've expanded our online store. I think online shopping is a trend that will grow, but I want it to be tacked on the side of our shops. I don't want it to be the forefront. If it becomes that, then sure, if that helps grow the way that we eat, the accessibility to quality foods, that's something I'm definitely willing to do. But I'm hoping one of the trends we'll see is my business spreading around, and it will hopefully make everybody's opinions on farm shops, food, production, all relevant to what we're talking about today. And I know it's quite a self-engrossed thing to say, but I'm hoping Radmore Farm will be part of Cambridge's new trend. I mean, it's definitely on the up. People are very interested in it. And that side of things, having ties to production, is something everybody in Cambridge seems to really want. We've got a lot of people here today who are really interested in what we're doing. And Cambridge is, I've never known a place like it for diversity, for wonderful people, understanding people who are willing to go out of their way and try new businesses and to promote new businesses. And I think, so the trend, I think, is only on the up for businesses like ours.
Joe?
I think certainly the beer trade is going to take a bit of a kicking. Pubs are struggling. We're drinking more at home. We're eating out more casually, which, with our current licensing laws, is making things difficult for pubs and the alcohol side of things, certainly. But at the upside, we are seeing more microbreweries opening. We're seeing more different stuff opening. We're seeing more cider production. We've got 3-4 new cideries being opened recently. Where we're going to go, I don't know. I know I'm sitting between two people I really want to talk to, one on a farming side and one on sustainability and farming side, because I want to take Black Bar down its own small holding route and looking at its sustainability and its energy usage and keep pushing down that side. That's where my interest has been. Beyond that, I think the food scene's growing. They're coming out to the brewery now, Christ, if they're coming out as far as me, then it's slowly filtering out of the city, which is great, you know, wonderful. And they're coming out to the villages. If I'm here this time next year, back in another eat food thing, it's got to be good. This is my second year of doing an event. And if next year I can do it with one of the three over there, or even better, the three of us over here are all coming collaborating with you three. And I think collaboration is a word I'd like to see more of. You know, if I can come over and, you know, drag Tim out of Fitzbillies and go, right, come on, do a beer. Let's go and do something stupid. Let's have a play.
I've been working a lot in Bristol recently, and they've got this so tight. They've even got a Bristol pound.
Yeah. Yeah.
And somebody explained to me the other day that if you spend a pound regularly in a small town, something like 85p of it will go outside of the town.
Yep.
If you spend your town pound, 85% of it stays inside. You'll recirculate again amongst independents for local businesses.
Yep.
I only heard about this 2 weeks ago because I'm at the food festival there, and I just suddenly thought, Jesus, somebody in Cambridge has got to know about this. We've got to find out more about this. Yeah. But actually, I can predict for next year the Cambridge pound. That's got to come out somewhere. Yeah.
I think you've just started it there. Yeah. I think
we have, a trend.
We're on that. If we could do more local support, it's getting more, you know, we're all here.
I don't think there's anyone here who wouldn't be really up for doing something. Yep. Collaborating, absolutely. Yep. I mean, everyone's here on their own accord. We want to do it. We want to push food. And
drink.
And food and drink. I eat my beer.
Yeah, all right. Then you're a man after my heart, that's fine. It's okay. None of this light, fluffy stuff.
Well, for me, I want to take things down a slightly different route. It's around nutrition. And what I would love to see is people understanding what they can eat and not have all these rules about what they can't eat. So actually, the carbohydrate report, there was a very tiny little bit about sugar, and it is called the sugar report. What most of it was about dietary fibre and what we should be eating and the sorts of food we should be eating and how we should be enjoying our food and how it is all about balance. So for me, that's what I hope is going to happen.
That's also something that we could all, like the collaboration we're talking about. Mm. I don't have the answer, but if you had something you wanted my customers to read or something you had of interest, I'll put in every single bag that goes out of the shop. Seriously, it wouldn't be a problem.
Yeah.
And we have, I mean, I have hundreds, thousands of customers every week or month, and they would all, I guarantee you, read it. Mm. And so there's little tiny changes we could make just like that that would actually boost certain things.
For education. Mm.
It's full circle. Mm.
So we're really talking sustainable, sensible nutrition and food and enjoying.
And enjoying. Exactly.
We were the first business in Cambridge to receive a Sustainable Food Award. And they're really big on it at the moment. And they just came into the shop and had a look around, and they are just ticking boxes. And I was delighted because I've always tried to be sustainable by buying the best products to sell, because we sell so many, but also the way I farm, the way we produce. And so it was actually quite infectious. Now I'm like, right, I'm looking at my trays. I'm looking at the plastics we use. And then before you know it, again, it becomes infectious. If I had a nutrition about what you're saying, I'd be like, hold on a minute then. Well, what about the rusk we put in sausages? What about, and it spreads. And I think people like us, you're not in the trade you're in because you sit back and can't be. But you're buzzing. You'll go home tonight and you won't sleep because you're just buzzing about what you've got to do tomorrow. A new product you can make, a new dish you can make, a new beer idea you've got. Just from all of this, and I think that spreads, and I think it's true. The beer you eat. Here we go. We're amazing. eat your beer.
If anybody wants to know where I'll be in the nearest bar. So. Thinking gently. Yeah.
Okay. Do we have any other questions or queries from the panel? No. Thank you very much indeed. So we've really enjoyed this, I hope, and to say thank you very much again to Dr. Marianne Ha. And to Ben Aveling and Joe Kennedy, Tim Hayward, Vivaya Kondakaiti, and Alex Rushmer. So thank you so much. And yes, let's hope it's going to be here again this time next year. Thank you.
It was one of those debating topics where we were never going to get a definitive answer. Our thanks, of course, to the Cambridge Union and to Eat Cambridge. The debate was chaired by Dr. Sue Bailey and was engineered for Cambridge 105 by Rob Chipperfield. The editor was me, Julian Clover.